today on Rambling About Cars. Horsepower, 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 more horsepower. And new we're not cars. Just talking about new cars. We're not just talking about supercars. We've had like 16 vehicle debuts in like the last week, and we're losing our minds. And we're going to try to talk about some of them, not all of them. One of those is from Mitsubishi. So we can't not talk about Mitsubishi's very interesting history in the United States. Mm-hmm. Some of its interesting cars. We love Mitsubishi. We're sad to see kind of what's happening now. It's an insane episode, Rambling About Cars, friends, boys and girls around the world, minions of metallic paint. Chris Bruce.
I'm here.
On the other side of the screen. Help me out here. I need a drink. Already.
We take a drink. So folks, here's what's happening. Auto shows don't happen anymore, or at least international auto shows. And what that means is that automakers have to debut their vehicles online. And they're doing it as opposed to all of these debuts happening like at a dedicated event that we're at. They're all happening kind of ad hoc. So like Smith said, in the past week, we have seen at least 16 reviews, and it's early in the week, and there might be a few more that we're missing or that were kind of minor enough that we're not mentioning here, but I'm going to go down the list just so you know how big this is. And just so you know, we're going to dig down into some of the bigger ones, but I want you to realize kind of how big the past week has been for the auto industry. So sit back. Here we go. We've got the Ford Explorer King Ranch, you know, kind of a mid-high level trim of that. We got the Land Rover Defender V8. It's finally getting a bigger engine. Kia Carnival, used to be known as the Sedona. They changed the name. New Mercedes-Benz C-Class. We'll get to that in a minute. Honda Ioniq 5. Also, we're going to get to that in a minute, but it's their new EV. The Gordon Murray T50S Niki Lauda. Big lame. Big name. That big, was not a Freudian slip. It wasn't.
Big lame. I heard that.
No, yeah, I said it, but it's not what I meant. Big name, huge price tag. Lexus IS500. You're going to be able to get a V8 in the IS class again. The Karma GS6. The Cupra Formentor VZ5. It's got an inline 5. It also sounds like an assault rifle. you've got the new Nissan Qashqai, which is also the new Rogue Sport, right?
Right.
Right, Rogue Sport. Yeah, sorry. Honda HRV, or the Vezel in some places. The new McLaren Artura, which is their new entry-level car, but it still costs $250,000, so it's twice as much as my house.
We'll talk about that, though, because that's a pretty special car.
We will. We'll talk about that. The new Mitsubishi Outlander, which we'll also discuss, and we'll be even talking about even more Mitsubishi later. The new Porsche 911 GT3, which we'll also be discussing, but is just a gorgeous piece of machinery.
Can we just talk about that for like 2 hours?
I'm happy to. It's just that this is going to be a 4-hour podcast. Then how much I need to talk about Mitsubishi.
We're not
going to
do that.
The Ford Expedition XL STX for your kind of light off-roading needs. And then the new Chevrolet Bolt / Chevrolet Bolt EUV. Because they're both, the EUV is the new like crossover esque version, but the Bolt is also getting some upgrades.
And to be fair, that one I think is like 10 days old. That wasn't in the last week, but it's
recent enough.
It's close enough. So yeah, there's a little slice into our life here for the last week. And Bruce is right. I mean, ordinarily we would have, we would have the Detroit Auto Show.
This would be Detroit.
Technically is moved. Yeah. To summer or fall, or I don't think they even know now.
This would be a little Detroit, a little Chicago, I think.
Little Detroit, Chicago. We would be coming up to, I think, Geneva.
Mm-hmm.
And then we would also be coming up to New York in March. And so, I mean, this is kind of auto show season. Automakers, there are no auto shows. So to the automakers that are listening, thank you to those that give us a week or so advance notice, with embargoed information.
Also, do better live streams, automakers. This is inside baseball, but do better live streams.
A live stream should actually be live, not just a recorded video. We want to see that live stuff. We're getting a little off track. Let's
a touch.
We ran down a huge list. Bruce, what do we want to start with? We're so organized. We're like, we got this list. What are we
going to
start with?
I'm going to start with the tab that I'm looking at right now.
Okay.
Which is the new 911 GT3.
Oh, that's a good place to start.
Yeah, it's really pretty. So interestingly, what Porsche did was they took their regular Carrera like they always do, and they made it, they gave it more. But what they did was they took the double wishbone suspension out of their race cars and they put it into this. So whereas you get a McPherson strut front suspension in your other Porsches, or your other 911s, I should say, you are getting, a proper race kind of spec front end setup on this. Also, you are getting the 4-liter the 4-liter flat six. That was in, what did it debut in? The 2019 911 Speedster. It is basically the same engine, except Porsche says there are now different pistons for it. The output is exactly the same, so I assume probably the different pistons are, maybe it's a bit more efficient somewhere. Porsche wouldn't change something out if they didn't need to.
And that's 502 horsepower, is that correct?
Is it 502 or 500 dead? It is 502, yeah.
502, and it's still naturally aspirated.
And it revs to 9,000 RPM. Oh my,
that's, I mean, is there a more delicious vehicle on the market really today? I mean, yes, there are hypercars with insane, insane amounts of power. There are all kinds of cars that have great soundtracks. But this, I mean, come on, that's a 4-liter six-cylinder, naturally aspirated, 502 horsepower, 9,000 RPM red line. Hearing these cars, I mean, we've certainly seen plenty of spy videos of the car
running, for ages.
Testing at the Nürburgring. That of all the cars really right now on the market, that's like in my top three that I really want to drive. I don't want the turbo, that naturally aspirated.
Brandon Turkus, our boss, would disagree with you. He called it the best winter car ever, the standard 911 turbo, on Twitter recently. So he might disagree with you, but
it's okay. He can disagree. I mean, he doesn't make him right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But what I wanted to point out here is that, I don't have a picture handy, but in other versions of the 911, they've gone to this very weird automatic transmission setup, or DCT, where it looks like someone just plugged a USB port into the center console, and that is the gear shift. For the 911 GT3, this looks like a manual transmission lever, but it's not. It is actually the lever for the DCT. So it looks proper, it looks good, and it also looks like it would just feel a lot more comfortable in your hand than that stupid blocky thing they've been using on other models. So I think that's another advantage of this model, is that they're going to that.
You know what? I'm fine with that. I'm not one of these people that are totally against the dual clutch gearboxes, the paddle shift.
Oh, and you can get a manual in this too. So no, you can get a 6-speed manual or 7-speed PDK. It's just that when you get the PDK, it looks like you have a manual.
Well, I'll take the PDK because I want to go fast. And I know that alone will hopefully get us some hate mail, but yes, you know what? I can shift a lot quicker with those paddles than you can with a manual, and you still get gear control. You still get that manual selection. That's what manual enthusiasts are always clamoring about. And I'm one of them, give me that car with a PDK. I will drive the wheels.
Cause I want to show the viewers at home what the manual looks like, or what the PDK on other models look like, just so that they understand that it's ugly.
and this is other reason right here, catch us on YouTube, because instead of just the auditory experience, you get the visuals of me and Bruce emoting ourselves. You can see our crazy backgrounds. You can see us legitimately getting excited about some of these things. And then later on, you can watch us getting legitimately terribly disappointed.
This is the career for us. And if you look down there, it's going to be what? To the bottom right of the steering wheel. Mm-hmm. You see the little thing sticking out, which again, to me, it looks like someone just plugged a USB key into the steering wheel.
Yep. Oh, that's your thumb drive. That's where you save all of your information on on what gears you're using the most often. And then you can plug it into your computer at home and relive your day's journey.
It's not Porsche. Like Porsche, you always think form follows function. That's not that doesn't look like it's comfortable to touch at all. That's just it's ugly.
So. I mean, it's a big toggle switch is really what it is. It's a big toggle switch.
Yeah.
And it looks goofy. At least they're still offering something there for people, as opposed to just like a little rotary dial, which I'm sure. completely against. That's a podcast for another time.
Yeah.
What else you got on the 9/11, Bruce?
That was kind of I think we need to kind of keep this train of moving.
We do.
We got a lot to talk about.
We do.
Is there one you want to talk about next, or would you like me to bring something up?
Well, let me just talk quickly about the Mercedes C-Class.
Sure.
Because I mean that just cropped up
today as of this recording.
Yeah, technically today as of this recording, which is February 23rd. I mean, anytime there's a new kind of a bulk vehicle from Mercedes, and certainly the C-Class is among them. I mean, it's something that we at least need to spend a little bit of time on.
And I think it's pretty.
And it is. I mean, look, they're taking a lot of cues from the S-Class. There's more sharpness in the style. I've heard a lot of people say that, well, it doesn't look like all new C-Class. It looks like a refresh. And yeah, I mean, it kind of does. But Mercedes has always been kind of about that evolutionary versus revolutionary style. The C-Class is certainly popular. The big change here isn't necessarily what you see on the outside. It's what you see on the inside. And the inside is pretty much S-Class, mm-hmm. which is a very big departure. It's got the big 12.3-inch screen. It's the digital cockpit inside, and I think it looks just fantastic. Let's see if I can pull some pictures.
I got it right here for you. Don't worry.
Bruce, you are on the ball, man. Look at that.
There it is.
And I mean,
that's a gorgeous interior.
Is there a company right now that's doing interiors better than Mercedes?
I think, you know, we have talked to our inside EVs friends, and some of them might say Tesla. I'm going to disagree with them, but
I mean, it's a specific style. There's a lot of gloss in there. The screens are large. It sort of has the turbine effect going for the vents and the dash. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that just looks like an attractive, exciting place to be. Now, mind you, I mean, we're talking about the C-Class. We're not talking about the AMG models,
which we don't even know about yet. We know they're coming.
We know they're coming.
Yeah,
we know they're coming. Now, I mean, underneath in the U.S., this car has the 2-liter turbo. Everything has hybrid assist now for Mercedes. So the power is, I think, 255 horsepower, which I mean, that's an entry level C300.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not a bad car at all.
We know that there more powerful versions are coming. So 255, right. That's the starting point. We know that there's going to be a C53. We know that there's going to be a C63. Like, there are going to be more powerful versions on the way. So 255 is the basement, and it's only going to go up from there.
Right. Now, the one thing that kind of bugs me a little bit about this, and we've been seeing this a lot from automakers, this car just debuted February 23rd. That's mm-hmm. when we're recording this podcast, February 23rd. It's not going to be available in the U.S. until a year from now. So they've debuted a car. Now you have to wait a year for it.
My only argument against that is that it is going to be available sooner in Europe.
Yep.
And so they kind of had to, you know, they kind of had to balance things. They had to tell the Europeans about what they were going to get. And then it was kind of a mea culpa. Sorry, Americans, you got to wait a little bit longer. But here's at least what you can expect. Right.
But I mean, our base model is at least a little step up in Europe. I think it goes down to
201,
like a 180 or something like that. I think
it's a 1.5 making 201 horsepower.
Okay. Yeah. Which still isn't bad, but I mean, yeah, Europe, they're always going to have something a little bit earlier than we're going to get when it comes to Mercedes. So that's just something we'll have to live with. But you know what? It looks like it's worth the wait for me. Honestly, if I'm looking at this versus a BMW 3 Series or a 4 Series, I'm taking the C-Class every day of the week.
And, oh, especially the new 4 Series is just I'm not talking about the interior. The exterior is just so. Yeah, I'm going C-Class.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not even basing that on the grill, on the BMW grill, which, yeah, we don't even need to get into that discussion. For several years now, I just think Mercedes, I mean, they've just been making just the right decisions when it comes to style inside and out. Performance is still there. Once upon a time, I would take the BMW over Mercedes. Mm-hmm. Not now.
I'm the same way. E46, I would take the C-Class. Yeah. We live in a weird world. We live in a fun world.
That we do. Okay, take us away on the next one.
Yep. So from I guess it's not even Mercedes' smallest sedan anymore with the CLA. Regardless, Lexus's smallest sedan, the IS, is you're going to be able to get it with a V8 again, which is kind of nice. I can't really, you know, get upset with that. I will have an image for it up here in a second,
but it's not an ISF, right?
It's an ISF Sport Performance is.
But it's not a full blown F.
No, it is not. They keep splitting hairs. So they have the ISF Sport, which you can get with the IS350, and now the IFF Sport Performance for the 500, and we hope that means that there's going to be a full-on, full-blown ISF, because if not, I don't know what Lexus is doing.
It'll be interesting to see if that's the case when it comes out.
Well, we don't even know that it's going to come out, because they've been talking about that twin-turbo V8 for ages and ages and ages, but because of, in 2020, with COVID, they didn't get to run it at the 24 hours of the Nürburgring. It was supposed to be an Lexus LC. That never happened. Toyota/Lexus has pulled out of 24 hours of the Nürburgring for this coming year, for 2021. So we don't know if that vehicle's ever going to happen. Presumably they created that twin turbo V8, but we don't know when or where it's going to show up. Things are weird at Lexus right now.
Well, and looking at this car right here, I mean, to me, this car looks kind of weird. I've made it known many, many times on social media and among my colleagues that I've never been a fan of the big Lexus spindle grill. I don't think there's anything
better
they can
than
do.
Usual, though, right?
No, it's really not. And it's not just the grill. It looks like they're trying to compete with BMW to see how much batshit crazy stuff they can have going on at the front clip. Sorry, Centers, you're going to have to bleep that out. But I mean, it just, it has an aggressive look, but to me, it's just, it's too busy. It's trying to do too many, it's trying to take too many different angles going in too many different directions at once.
So I have been an apologist for the Lexus spindle grill forever. And I also think this is one of the better implementations of it. And also we haven't given the vehicle its due yet. It's a 5-liter naturally aspirated V8 making 472 horsepower. Now, if that sounds familiar, it's the same engine in the RCF, but here you get two extra doors. So if you have kids, if you have a dog, if for whatever reason you need access to that rear row of seats often, you know, this is the one to get, just because of those extra two doors. Otherwise, the two vehicles are pretty similar, but it's just nice to see, you know, Lexus kind of broadening that out, in my opinion.
And I'm sure it would be a fun vehicle to drive. I mean,
well, hell yeah, it's a 5 liter V8 making nearly 500 horsepower. It's gonna be a blast. You know, I think you and I are both kind of saying that we wish Lexus would go a step farther. That this is nice, but we want a real ISF. You know, if you're gonna do it right. Don't launch this F Sport performance brand, sub brand, or whatever you want to call it. Give us the full fat version. Give us the ultimate version, and then maybe cut it back a little rather than going the other way. Is that fair?
I mean, that makes sense to me. Honestly, I'm just sitting here looking at this picture and thinking, if we could just put a little red bar right underneath where the top part of the grill comes in at its closest 2 points. Just put a little red bar right there to separate the top from the bottom. That's all you need. Saying. That little piece, that thing would look outstanding.
And here's the engine cover. And the other thing is, I feel like Lexus needs to go away from these plastic engine covers that look nice. But if you've ever looked at an ISF without its engine cover on, it's just the spaghetti like mess of wires and vacuum hoses and everything else. Like if you're gonna sculpt an engine and make it look clean, you know, other automakers can do it. You can do it Lexus can do it. Oh, what's the name of that stupid thing? What's the Lexus hypercar that
LFA?
The LFA. Thank you. Like that.
One of my favorite cars of all time, by the way.
Naturally. And it's a gorgeous engine. And they need to be able to do that again rather than, you know, plastic engine covers are what they will. So,
well, and plastic engine covers don't really bother me that much just because of what you just said. Underneath, it's a mess of hoses, wire looms, and it's ugly, and it's a fact of life for modern engines. There's that much electrification going on in there. I mean, there are sensors all over the place.
Yeah,
that's you need all of that stuff. So rather than trying to be clever and possibly adding thousands of dollars more to the price by trying to find a neat way to package this, just do it up nice and neat, put a decent looking engine cover over the top and call it good. Honestly, I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that.
Well, I'm going to let you introduce our next friend here, which is the new McLaren Artura. It is the replacement for McLaren's entry-level model, the 570S.
It's quite a replacement.
Oh, it's a – yeah. First off, no longer a V8, now a V6. Now hybrid-assisted.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just looking at it, I think it's a step in the right direction from, you know, from vehicles like the Senna, the 720. I don't know, the front end always kind of looked a little funny to me. I mean, they're still sizzling when it comes to performance. The Artura, I mean, yes, it's a V6, and there are people out there saying, "Oh, McLaren, you're going V6." It's a twin turbo 3 liter V6, 577 horsepower. Just from the V6. Now, this being a full-on hybrid, it has the single electric motor that's in line with the powertrain. So it's not adding a ton of weight. The combined output of this car is 671 horsepower, rear-wheel drive, 0-60 in 3 seconds flat, which when you're talking about their entry-level car, that's almost as fast as the McLaren P1, the previous hybrid. This isn't taking the place of the P1, obviously, but like the P1, you can run this on electric only power for, I think it's like 19 miles. So it has that aspect to it. Top speed, 205 miles an hour. It uses McLaren's new architecture. That's friendly for hybrids. And I mean, you know, inside it looks handsome, outside it looks handsome. It's 3,300 pounds. Which I think is really, really good for a hybrid.
Right. It's for
a hybrid that can run a certain distance just on electric power alone. I think that does a very good job. The price, it's $225,000 in the US, but that's still a lot cheaper than you typically see hypercars like this going for, and you're getting a little bit of efficiency with it. I love it. It's on sale later in 2021. I'm excited for this hybrid and electric future. I know I'm probably in the minority when it comes to enthusiasts on that, but bring it up. Well,
I agree with you. And what especially interests me is that what we've been seeing from the new 765 LT on dynos and whatnot is that McLaren has started underrating their power plants. So I'm wondering once we get a hold of one of these and can put it on a dyno, what it actually makes.
Right.
Because I wonder if 671, like, what if it makes 670 at the wheels, not at the crank?
That's
like,
kind of been the trend. I mean, the 765
LT. For McLaren's, LT, it has been. Yeah.
It's almost making that power. Well, and in some cases, we've seen it's actually making a little bit more than that at the wheels. So, yeah, 671 combined horsepower with the twin turbo V6 and the electric motor. You would think, okay, that's you know, shaft power. Is that at the wheels?
And if it is, well, then that makes for $250,000, that makes that much more of a bargain much more quickly, because you're going to end up with something that can embarrass a lot, put it that way. Like, practically, other than probably its big brothers, you know, it's going to be able to put down that power and beat anything in a straight line that you can get it, you can put up against it. So yeah, I'm interested. I'm anxious to learn more is the way I would say it.
And you know what? I mean, on sale later this year. Yeah. I don't know if we'll see any in customers' hands by the end of 2021.
Maybe couple.
But I mean, we certainly keep an eye out for things like this, and especially McLaren now with the way they've been kind of underrating their own vehicles. I'm really curious to see more about the Artura.
Yeah.
Bruce, you got anything else on your list there before we get to the grand finale?
Do you
want me to talk about Hyundai?
Please talk about Hyundai. I don't have the images that pulled up. So yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well, let me go ahead and pull this up here because, yeah, while we're talking about electrics and electric vehicles.
Electrified vehicles.
Actually, let me switch my screen here. There we go. We've got the Ioniq here, the Ioniq 5. This just debuted. And what's neat about this, it's not a performance vehicle. Okay. It's an SUV. It's a fully electric SUV.
Is it an SUV?
Well, okay. Now we're going to get back to the definitions of SUVs and crossovers. Some call it an SUV. I guess you could call it a crossover. I mean, it's got available all wheel drive.
Well, it's not even so much that, like, when you look at the proportions it looks like a 5-door hatchback with kind of a weird body shape,
It's a big 5-door hatchback. Hyundai says this has more space inside than their Palisade,
which means it's a lot of space because the Palisade is a big girl.
Yeah, it's a big girl. It's technically classified as a midsize SUV. That's going by what the announcements say. But you're right, it does sit kind of low. It has that hatchback kind of look at the ride height. What I think is neat about this is, it's really not that much different from the concept. And we don't see that happen very often with automakers. They'll come out with a concept. I mean, with occasional exceptions, like the Grand Wagoneer concept they call it a concept. What it is, it's just probably an early prototype of their actual vehicle. This came out first as a concept, and the finished product looks very much like a concept. I think it looks kind of neat, I'll be honest. And because it's fully electric, it has a completely flat floor inside, which is why they get so much space inside. Because there's no engine in front, it also has a frunk. So you get extra storage space up there, plus extra storage space in the back. What is it? I think it's 24 liters of storage space in the front, I think.
That sounds right.
Because it has the flat floor, it's got a cool sliding console. And I think that's a neat trick. You can have the center console that's usually between the front seats. You can actually slide that back. It was noted somewhere that, you know, if you happen to park in a spot and you come out and somebody has parked very close next to you on one side, it's much easier to get in the passenger side and just move right over. Hey, you know what? If
I don't that know helps, when that's going to happen,
if that helps, argument. I mean, hey, if that helps sell the vehicle, we'll go for it. Of course, I mean, it's got the fully digital cockpit. It's got solar panels on the roof. Power wise, like I said, it's not a performance vehicle in its base form. It has a single electric motor at the back for rear-wheel drive. You can also get it all-wheel drive. The base form is 168 horsepower. The most powerful version will have all-wheel drive. The combined output from the front and rear motors is 302 horsepower. Yep, I've got that on my notes. 302 horsepower. That's not bad at all. 0 to 60 in 5.2 seconds. I mean,
also fairly quick.
That will hang with all kinds of quote unquote performance vehicles out there. And then, of course, since we're talking an EV, depending on the battery you get, you can get the smaller battery, you can get the bigger battery. It has a range of 298 miles on the biggest battery,
what they're estimating. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, these are estimates, obviously, at this point. Certainly a competitive range. The thing that's that I think is pretty neat on this car too, it can charge at the 800 volts. Is that what it is? The 800 volt setting, I think.
That means
you can charge, I think, up from 10 to 80% of its range in about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And if you need a quick charge, you can get 62 miles of range in 5 minutes.
And here's what I think. It's a very good blend of retro and modern. That they're not technically rectangular, you know, like seal beam headlights, although they look like that. But, you know, it's a really nice touch. And it's a handsome car. And I think that Hyundai's going in the right direction with this. And we know it rides on their EGMP platform. So we're going to see Kia and Genesis vehicles on the same platform in the future. So, you know, they're all going to look a little bit different. They're going to have the same underpinnings. And I think Kia, as opposed to a lot of automakers, is really being serious about EVs in the right way.
And it's got the Z on the side. When you look at the side profile, okay, so the Legend of Zorro, way before my time still. But I mean, I just think, okay, the big Z on the side, zero. I'm such a nerd. We need to move on.
Sure. So last but not least, not to give kind of away our traffic info or anything like that, but you folks, it turns out you really like the new Mitsubishi Outlander.
I won't say that was a surprise because, I mean,
no, it's a surprise.
SUVs are popular, but yeah, the Mitsubishi Outlander.
And it's, you know, it's not a normal looking vehicle. Like
it's a very bold approach.
And what's interesting is that the underpinnings, because of the shared pieces with the Renault, Mitsubishi, Nissan alliance, it's actually a Nissan Rogue more or less underneath. So what they did was those are all unique body panels, but a lot of the underpinning bits are shared with Nissan. It's an interesting thing. You get a 2.5 liter inline four and a CVT. The engine makes 181 horsepower and 181 pound feet of torque. And that's also on the Rogue, funnily enough. If you look on the inside, if you give me just a moment here.
I will say this, Mitsubishi, you did not need to take Nissan CVT.
Did for money reasons.
They sell three vehicles in the United States, and this is one of them. This is the Outlander is actually their best selling vehicle.
Yeah.
So to take this big of a step away from the outgoing Outlander, which admittedly was pretty old in the world of SUVs.
Oh, it was very old.
Credit to Mitsubishi, you're taking a big gamble with this. That's a very bold look. I kind of dig it. I mean, it's weird in a way where it's like it's not a bad kind of weird, I don't think. And the inside looks, I mean, the inside looks pretty handsome.
And I agree. So we are looking at the interior now. This is the new Rogue, or I'm sorry, this is the new Outlander. And here comes, wait, no, because no, I have the image right. Up. Here comes the new Rogue. For folks watching on YouTube,
there is a lot of similarity. I know I haven't seen them side by side yet, so I'm the touch screen is
the dashboard identical. The materials are different, but the overall design is the same.
Yeah.
And it is what it is. Like, you know, that's the advantage of having that kind of alliance, is that you can borrow bits and pieces. The outside of the Mitsubishi looks nothing like the Rogue. It's just right. That, you know, a lot of the other bits do. And that's kind of what Mitsubishi needs right now, that they are still in that rebuilding phase of their brand. And
well, it's certainly familiar territory, a little bit of foreshadowing there.
Yeah.
It's certainly familiar territory. Is the Outlander available as a 3-row?
It is only available as a 3-row.
It's only a 3-row because the Rogue. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you can't get 3 rows in a Rogue, can you?
Outlander is only available as a 3-row. My Rogue knowledge, I have to admit,
I'm pretty sure. And if we're wrong, send us email podcast@motorone.com. I'm pretty sure the Rogue is only available as a five passenger.
2-row, 5 seats.
So, I mean, Nissan people, if you want a Rogue with 7 seats, maybe.
Yes, stop the Rogue does come in a 5-seater. I am not seeing a 7-seater. Yeah. So,
I mean, that's an interesting plus to Mitsubishi here, but you know, I mean, that's the 2.5 liter naturally aspirated 4-cylinder. What do you see? That was 170, 181. Could you imagine 181 horsepower with a CVT loaded with 7 people?
I mean, in a pinch, it'll be fine. You're not going to be able to tow with it, but like, right. You know, that's not what this is for.
Right. And maybe I'm being a little harsh. Mitsubishi, you're taking a pretty bold step here. Bravo. We want to see you back with awesome vehicles, you know, starring in our rally dreams. What do you say we move on to the second segment here, Bruce?
I think we should. But I think we need to just for a moment, please. If you have a cool car, send it to us. We asked you to do this week, last week, and no one did.
We're still waiting to refresh your memory. We want to make this a recurring segment. Bruce and I just don't want to sit here talking about the stuff that we wrote about last week and some other topics. We want to bring you, the listener or the watcher, into the discussion with us. And I know there are just amazing car stories out there that haven't been told, and we want to share them. We want to help you share them.
And yeah, so please just send us an email. Send us, you know, share.
Send us a message.
Yeah.
podcast@motorone.com. Hey, if you're comfortable, you can also drop comments into our YouTube videos. You can drop comments into the articles that go up every Friday. Of course, the Rambling About Cars podcast launches every Friday. You can also catch it on Spotify. You can catch it on Apple Podcasts, The Whole Shot, Mitsubishi. We need to talk about some Mitsubishi.
We do.
Bruce, did you know? Of course, we were just talking about the Outlander.
We were.
With its Nissan
underpinnings,
bones, so to speak.
Interior.
The first Mitsubishi, 1917, it had a Fiat platform. So it's like, even from the very beginning, Mitsubishi had this kind of collaboration going on with other automakers. And right. Would you say that that's kind of been a trend through Mitsubishi's entire automotive history?
To one extent or the other, it totally has been. Like, that first one was, you know, they used a Fiat platform. They used their own engine. So it's kind of a, you know, it's a mix there. Mitsubishi as its own automaker, Mitsubishi Motors, became a thing in 1970. And so it didn't, by 1971, Chrysler had invested in it. Mm-hmm. At that point, even at that point, Chrysler knew they kind of needed to have some sort of import cars. You know, there was Volkswagen at the time. Ford had like their tiny Falcon. Chevy was already like experimenting with the Vega. Like small cars were already a thing at that point. And so Chrysler knew they needed to do something, and they saw this opportunity. And so they partnered with Mitsubishi and they came out with the Colt. And the first model year for that is 1971. It's 1971. And here are the first body styles of that. And you can see, you could get quite a few. You got a wagon. You've got a traditional sedan with a post. You've got a fastback. You've got a coupe or whatever you want to call it. You've got
everything you could want right there. And right. Isn't it interesting that as automakers around the world, but especially in the United States, as they were facing, fuel and emissions crisis, smaller cars, more efficient cars were the thing. When you look at Detroit, I mean, Ford, they were building their own stuff. GM mm-hmm. was building their own stuff. Chrysler just like ripped every Mitsubishi they could find, put their badge on it and brought it over here.
Which was simpler. They didn't have to invest in engineering. Right. These were existing cars. This was a Mitsubishi Galant that they were just like, well, send them on over.
Right. We'll put some badges on them. I mean, at one point, sorry, Mopar guys, the Dodge Challenger was actually a Mitsubishi for a little while, was it not?
It was.
I'm trying to think off the top of my head. I don't know. It was like late 70s, early 80s.
I believe it's 78.
That was the Dodge Challenger came back, and it was really a Mitsubishi. Was that the Galant still?
That was also a Galant variant.
Oh, that's right.
So the image we're showing here is 75. So this is a few years later, but the Dodge Colt GT, this is another Mitsubishi that they just like.
Yeah.
And there are no styling changes. If you look the Japanese version of this up, it's the same vehicle. It's just got, you can see the Dodge logo on the hood. And they did that. And that was totally acceptable at the time. And those vehicles were popular enough that they kept Chrysler going through the 70s. And that was a rough time for the company.
And you know what? I think now maybe I'm wrong on this, because the 70s, a little bit before my time. So if there are some listeners out there that know this better than we do, because I mean, hey, we know a lot, but we don't know everything. Email us podcast@motorone.com. We're legitimately interested in hearing from people that were well acquainted with cars in the 1970s. Was it commonly known that these Chrysler vehicles were actually rebadged Mitsubishis? Because, and here's the reason I ask that. I'm a child of the 80s, so I'm not too far from the 70s. And I consider myself fairly knowledgeable on automobiles. I didn't realize just how far back this whole Mitsubishi Chrysler relationship went, really, until like the early 2000s. And even then, well, actually not even the early 2000s. It was like the late 2000s, like 2009, 2010. The only reason then it came up was because I'm a big rally fan. Of course, Mitsubishi has done, they've made a little bit of a name in stage rally over the years, right?
So, and off-road rally with the Montero, Pajero, whichever you want to call it.
Oh, absolutely, for sure. So I'm at the, I was in Michigan at the time. I'm at the Snowdrift Rally. I think it was 2009 or 2010. I can't remember which year it was exactly. But I saw this car at the Snowdrift Rally, and I had no idea what it was at all. And I'm stalling because I'm trying to pull up a picture of the car that I have on my computer, and it's not coming up. So I'm just going to tell you. It was a 1980 Plymouth Fire Arrow. And I'm like, what the heck is a Plymouth Fire Arrow? But it was decked out in rally livery. And I've seen it in that was back when Rally America was still the sanctioning body for the series. And I mean, it was a cool car, rear wheel drive, is actually a Mitsubishi Lancer. And I had never realized that the Plymouth Arrow, I think it was the Dodge Arrow up in Canada, never realized, okay, that was actually a Mitsubishi Lancer. And I didn't learn that until 2009 or 2010 when I first came upon that car.
Well, I'm trying to help you out and pulling up. Oh, I've got one.
you got one there.
I do.
Yeah, Firefox. Oh, Firefox, you're the bane of my existence. But you're still better than Chrome.
Well, I'm using Chrome, and there is a Fire Arrow.
So, look at that. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know what? That's a cool-looking car. That is.
It is,
cool,
especially by 1980 standards. And we're not talking 1980s. We are talking literally the 1980 model year.
It's got the louvers. Look at the louvers on the back window.
And on the side.
That is late 70s, early 80s, like nothing else. The only thing that could top that would be like a 77 or a 78 Mustang King Cobra, right? With the louvers and the big silly snake on the hood. That's, yeah. And I never knew that was a Mitsubishi Lancer. And I feel kind of ashamed for it now. It's like, I'm supposed to know this stuff. But I didn't come upon that until 2010. And so, mind you, at that point, 2010, okay, I just started doing some automotive journalism on the side, but I had already been about 10 years in the auto industry, pretty deep, working marketing for Ford, and I had car clubs, and I was working, actually for a little while I worked as a vehicle valuator for the insurance industry, doing collectible and classic vehicles.
I didn't know that.
And I still didn't know that car, the Plymouth Fire Arrow, the Arrow.
It was the Arrow, car. And then the Fire was the sporty.
The Fire was the sporty one.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was a Lancer. And I want to hear from people a little bit older than me who were in the 70s. Did Chrysler really do that good of a job marketing their products to where?
Like the Colt, there was the Sapporo. There was the Challenger, which was the same thing as the Sapporo, which was also a Gallant. So I just real quick here. I really got to thank Allpar for this. They did an interview with Burton H. Bucomp, who did a lot of things. He, like it says here, he was a Chrysler product planner. But more interestingly, he also did Chrysler's he worked with their Japanese divisions, which meant Mitsubishi at the time. And in this story from Allpar that we'll link, he has this to say. The European products, and what he means by that is that in the very early 1970s, very late 1960s, Chrysler had a relationship with the French automaker Simca and some other companies also in Europe. The European products turned out to be unsatisfactory for the U.S. market and were replaced with Mitsubishi cars. The main problem were that the Roots quality, Roots was the automaker the Roots quality and reliability and the Simca style lacked an automatic transmission. Consequently, European products were dropped in the U.S. and Mitsubishi products were sold through both Plymouth and Dodge dealers. He then goes on to say, he kind of skips forward a full decade, and this is why Mitsubishi stopped being rebadged Dodges and Plymouths and started becoming its own automaker. This might have worked, but in the late 1970s, Mitsubishi was concerned that Chrysler was going out of the automobile business because at the time Chrysler had damn near went bankrupt. Yeah. So they negotiated the rights to set up their own distribution system in the U.S. That put Plymouth, Dodge, and Mitsubishi dealers in competition with each other selling the same products. That meant that business partners who were never very friendly became especially unfriendly competitors. In my opinion, that was the first step down a path which led to Chrysler and Mitsubishi's divorce. So, yeah, and those two paragraphs, you basically get two decades of history that Mitsubishi and Dodge or Chrysler were one, and then with Chrysler's kind of iffy financials, they weren't anymore.
And what a crazy, odd, messed up, and at times awesome relationship that was. I mean, they were competing. Of course, I mean, you had the Diamond Star Motors, and is there, I mean, there are okay, there are more iconic cars through the 90s than the Mitsubishi Eclipse, but there aren't many. I mean, think about
in the early 90s, it was important for its time.
Think about the mark that car left on culture for that time. And even to this day, you find an original first gen, like Eclipse or an Eagle Talon TSI all wheel drive that hasn't been modded and beat to death. They're really starting to bring some big money now. And would people have thought that back in the day? I mean, that relationship brought just some very cool cars. I'm gonna share an image right now of one of my favorite. Okay, this isn't a Diamond Star, but it's one of the coolest cars that I thought should have received so much more attention than it did, and really. For those not watching on YouTube, this is the Mitsubishi Galant VR4. All-wheel drive, the 4G63 four-cylinder turbo. This was the predecessor to the Lancer Evolution. And I've been so close to pulling the trigger on getting one of these cars so many times. And I've always had a thing for the late 80s, kind of early 90s sedans. I've had Subaru Legacies. I haven't had a Galant like this, but I've seen these cars in various stage rally events, all wheel drive turbo, such a neat car. I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit. I completely glossed over the Starion and the Dodge Conquest, the DSM pair there, but I couldn't hold this back anymore. I've been looking at this picture for like a half hour. It's like, okay, boom, here it is.
Well, no, but the interesting thing is that's basically the same powertrain as the Eclipse. It's just packaged into a sedan rather than a coupe. That's the major difference, really.
And then the Lancer came along, which was also the four door.
Yeah.
And I wonder why Chrysler never dipped a toe into the Galant. Because the Galant was sold here.
Yeah.
And you had the Eagle Talon and you had the Chrysler Laser. That were the DSM, Laser, the equivalent to the Eclipse. I've always wondered why we never had, why Chrysler never picked up a version of the Galant. Or, and this will blow your mind, did they? And somehow they snuck it past us? Because I doubt my own self these days when it comes to what came out of Chrysler and Mitsubishi's relationship over what, like 30 years when they first started in the 70s until they finally divorced?
A little over 30 years, I think. Oh. Yeah. A little over 30. Yeah. And the other thing is that it gets weird because at times, especially once Mitsubishi starts setting up their own dealers, it seems like Chrysler would kind of pull away and that they would come back towards them. So like your Dodge Avenger, your Stratus Coupe, and what's the other one? The Sebring, those all came out of the DSM factory in Illinois. But if you think about it, Chrysler was very, very good about their marketing that you never heard about that relationship. Like you kind of had to be into things to know that those were all cars that came essentially off the same assembly line.
Right. And, there's the whole Buy American movement, which support your country. Absolutely. I almost feel like Chrysler was working very, very hard to separate themselves from their Mitsubishi partners in Japan, because if their diehard Chrysler buyers ever learned that the engines and a lot of these vehicles were Mitsubishi engines. I mean, what kind of fallout would there have been? Am I wrong on that? Am I wrong on thinking that?
I don't think you're wrong, especially when we start thinking about the Mitsubishi 3000 GT and the Dodge Stealth, which are in essence, it is platform. It's badge engineering, but almost not quite.
Right. The stealth had a very, very different look. It wasn't just a badge.
No, it's a very different look, but mechanically they're identical vehicles. And that's what makes them interesting. So right now we're looking at a 3000 GT here, and I will have a stealth up for us in just a moment.
And shout out to everybody listening and watching who used the Mitsubishi GTO, which is what it was known as in Japan.
In Japan, yep.
Has the car that they used to beat and get through all the tracks in the original Gran Turismo. Raise your hand. That's me right there. You could take the old 3000, you could take the GTO, and just mod it up to like 1100 horsepower, bounce off the walls, and you could beat everything else out there. No skyline required.
I did it with an RX-7, but yeah, works that way too. But, so there is the stealth. And right. Again, like the styling is similar, but far from identical. Like to a layman, you could park those two cars next to each other and they wouldn't be able to tell the difference, but mechanically they're identical. And I think that's almost the best version of badge engineering, platform sharing, whatever you want to mm-hmm. call it. It's, you know, I have a bad taste about these cars because two guys I didn't like in high school, one had a Stealth and one had a 3000 GT. So
were they the turbo or were they the non-turbo?
No. They were both front wheel drive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, those cars.
Come on, it was high school. They were 17 years old. And I was 16.
Hey, you never know. But I mean, those cars, non-turbo front wheel drive. I mean, that's like the ultimate sheep in wolf's clothing.
Yeah.
They were kind of blah, but I remember when the Stealth came out, and I mean, and it was a big deal. And
oh yeah.
And I mean, I remember talking to people, that never really had the Mitsubishi connection. I remember auto magazines back in the day talked about, you know, it's, you know, DSM, it's parts, you know, it's partnered with the 3000 GT, but you know, kudos to Chrysler. They had so many Mitsubishi products in their portfolio. And I think a lot of people, even to this day, still don't realize it.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, we can't talk about this relationship without talking about the Eclipse. We touched on it earlier. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most iconic cars of the 1990s, the Mitsubishi Eclipse.
The early 90s, especially.
Especially the early 90s. I would love to have a first generation. And actually my choice Mitsubishi would actually be the Eagle Talon. I just always I like the styling of the Talon a little bit better.
Yep.
The second generation, when they got a little more rounded, see, that was what, 95, I think, when that came out, when they got a little more rounded. Now I switched to the Eclipse. The Talon just kind of looked weird. But what's interesting to me, as hot as these cars were, and even just with the turbo front wheel drive, they were still cool cars to have. All wheel drive, it's just like you felt like you were invincible until you blew it up. And let's be honest, a lot of people blew them up.
A lot of people did, yeah.
But then
they were fragile.
I would love to be a fly on the wall in some Mitsubishi meetings in the late 90s when they were saying, okay, well, we have this car, the Eclipse, and in America, at least, people really seem to love it. They love having the turbocharged engine. They love having the all-wheel drive. So for the next Eclipse, how about we get rid of the turbo engine and we get rid of the all-wheel drive? And you know what? The kids really like those Pontiac Grand Ams with those plastic rib sides. So let's put a heavier V6 up front and turn just the front wheels, and we'll stick some of that cladding on the side. That seems like the best way to go, right? And then you had this Eclipse that was am I wrong in saying that's the worst Eclipse they ever made?
They got worse as the time went on. They got
I don't know that I agree. We'll get to that in a bit. You've got an image up of the first generation Eagle Talon.
Yeah.
Look at that.
That's a first gen.
That's still a great looking car to this day.
I prefer the second gen, especially that bizarre wing. And I will have an image up of that here in just a second.
The second generation wasn't bad. have you ever driven one of those? I had the chance to drive one. And I mean, you want to talk about just a weird claustrophobic cockpit. I will say you feel a little vulnerable sitting in one of those just because they're so small. You feel like you're just kind of wrapped around this car. You do feel a little vulnerable. I have to say, I have to be honest on that, but I mean, they still looked cool. They still were just awesome to drive.
So that's the rear of a second gen. And it's just that weird, super thin wing. I think that's an attractive looking car.
I mean, it's not bad at all. I just happen to like the first generation better.
You're not wrong. It's just, it, you know, it's a matter of opinion.
But then things started to go bad. I'm trying to bring up a picture.
Things go real bad real quick.
Well, I bring up a picture of the third generation, why don't you explain to me how it got worse from there? Because I would say it got better. I would say it got a lot better.
Are you crazy after the second gen? Because they got rid of all-wheel drive. They got rid of turbocharging. So at that point, it was just a front wheel drive, to put it a nice way. I was going to say something mean. To put it a nice way, it was, how do they say, all hat, no cowboy? No, it's not that. I can't think of the, it was all show and no go at that point.
Well, The third generation was what, 2000 to, I think
it was 06. A little earlier than that. I want to say it was 98, but
somewhere on there. Anyways, it's this style here. Yes. Unfortunately, I do have a photo. Oh dear. There's the rib sides. There's the V6 badge.
See, here's the thing. I don't think if that car had a better powertrain, I don't think we would deride it as much. But it has a terrible powertrain.
It has the terrible powertrain. I think the V6 had, what was it, 200 horse? I know that there are going to be Mitsubishi people out there that are just yelling. They're either yelling into the stratosphere or they're yelling at their computer screen saying, these guys know nothing about Mitsubishis. We know enough to be dangerous. Come on. We know enough to know that this thing that we're looking at right now on the screen is not the best example of the Mitsubishi Eclipse. And yeah, they went with a heavier engine. They went with front wheel drive only. They got rid of the turbo. And let's be honest, how much horsepower does a stock Mitsubishi Eclipse turbo make? It doesn't matter what it makes because everybody that got one tuned it and turned it up. And that's what made it a legend. And you couldn't do that with this car. This car didn't have a turbo. You would have to buy an aftermarket turbo kit. And it's much easier to
fiddle with. They didn't make an aftermarket turbo kit for that car.
They didn't, or they did?
They did not.
Oh, I'm sure somebody did somewhere. It's an Eclipse. Somebody did somewhere. But now, do you think it got worse after that, or do you think it got better?
Oh, it got worse. I've got a photo coming up for you here of the final gen where it's just this ugly blob of a car.
It got some of its curves back. The V6 was up to like 260 some horsepower with a manual transmission. That's a pretty exciting car to drive. I think they were making steps in the right direction. They were making steps in the right direction. But here's some conspiracy theory stuff though. By this time in America, now we have an Evo, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Here comes the Lancer Evolution. The first generation in Japan was 92, I believe, and it entered World Rally Championship competition, and it dominated.
Wait, there's your Eclipse that we're talking about. Final gen Eclipse.
Yeah, look at that, man. That was kind of getting its mojo back. Come on. Come on. It's at least it maybe it's not as good as the first or second gen, but it's at least better than the third. It's better than the ribbed for somebody's pleasure.
I guess I can't fight
V6. Like,
maybe you're right, but it's just the fact that it's.
No, it's not turbocharged. It's not all wheel drive, yeah. But there's some serious grunt under the hood of that car. You can go out. I mean,
I guess
it's a lively car to drive.
You're killing me here.
And I thought it looked way better than the previous gen, but now Mitsubishi has a problem because I think the Evo 8, the eighth generation, it was the first one that came to the United States.
That's correct.
And now you have the turbocharged all-wheel drive car that the Eclipse used to be in the United States when we couldn't get the Evo that we really wanted. And by the way, Evo 4, I will have one someday. I lust after that car. Either an Evo 4 or an Evo 6, Tommy Mac in addition. Tommy Mack, come on, one of the best rally drivers of all time.
Yeah, anyways. I mean, he's building the Yaris GR right now. Like that's kind of his.
That's another podcast altogether, right there.
It is.
But now here's Mitsubishi. Oh, geez, do we make the Eclipse as awesome as the Evo is? So, you know, maybe it's another case of GM detuning the Camaro to make sure it doesn't outrun the Corvette, right? Did Mitsubishi intentionally not take its Eclipse to the next level because they didn't want to step on the Evo? But then, you know, eventually it all went away anyways.
And speaking of it all went away anyways. well, no. I don't mean that to me. Mitsubishi kind of went through a dark period in the late mid 2000s, mm-hmm, or 20 teens. I don't know what we're calling that area.
Early 20 teens, I think.
Yeah. But finally, 2016, they get acquired by Nissan Renault. And so now they are part of the, I think the technical name is the Renault Nissan Mitsubishi Alliance, because they're all kind of equal partners. Mm-hmm. And that is why the new new Outlander is, you know, it has so much in common with the Rogue. What do you think? Could this mean a good future for Mitsubishi? Like, what does this mean? Like, here's let me just say what I hope. So we know Nissan is working on a new Z car. What if, you know, it's not going to happen, but a person can dream. What if they make a Mitsubishi 4000 GT based off of the new Z car or something like that? What if they make a really good new Montero based off, what would it have to be? The Armada, I guess. Yeah, probably.
You know, that's a good point. We've been talking about performance cars, but the Montero was kind of a legend unto itself.
Oh, yeah. I had a whole section prepared about that we just never got to out of time.
But. Well, this could be another one of those things where, you know what, we'll have to come back to this. You know, I don't know what to say about that, but I will say this. Isn't it interesting how it seems like history is repeating itself? Because here's Mitsubishi and Chrysler through the 70s, and here come the late 70s, and Chrysler isn't looking in too great a shape financially. Mitsubishi's already been a part of that for a few years. Now, here we are, 2021. Nissan isn't looking that great financially, but Mitsubishi's already been a part of them for a couple years. If history repeats itself, God, good things could be just on the horizon. Great things could be just on the horizon. Isn't it fascinating to think about it that way, folks? I mean, we're almost in the same position right now with Mitsubishi, only the player now is Nissan instead of Chrysler.
It is. Now that you bring that up, it's especially interesting that except for kind of a very early period of time that pre-Mitsubishi Motors, when the other parts of that giant corporation were building their cars, that Mitsubishi has never really been an independent automaker. You know, they get established in 1970. 1971, Chrysler buys 15% of the company. And by the 80s, they own a quarter of that company. So, like, Mitsubishi is never really on its own, like, doing its own thing. They always have some sort of larger, richer corporate backer behind them. And it's never really not been like that in its history. It's a bizarre state of things.
It's such an bizarre and interesting automotive story. I wish we had more time to talk about it. I will say this. Right now, Mitsubishi has, what, three cars in its portfolio? The Mirage.
Outlander, Mirage, and Outlander Sport.
Okay, I guess four. Outlander Sport, Mirage, and the Eclipse Cross.
Yes.
So only four. I was looking at the sales numbers before we started talking here tonight. Last year, Mitsubishi's best-selling vehicle was the Outlander at 29,000.
And a new one is coming this year.
So, yeah. I mean, when you have just four vehicles, your best-selling does 29,000 in a year. That sounds like a good recipe for like a niche supercar manufacturer. but not that, I mean, Mitsubishi, I hope the new Outlander sells for you. I hope the partnerships continue to grow. We so desperately want to see more of the passion and more of these eccentric products that come from these love to hate relationships that you've had through the years. Who knows? Maybe Mitsubishi and Nissan can come to blows one day, take it to Jerry Springer, and then come up with like a new 4000 GT, GTR, V-Spec. I don't know, some sort of weird collaboration that can once again become a legend like the Lancer Evo did, you know?
So I'm just, as you're mentioning this, I'm just thinking, like, Mitsubishi could, I hope it rediscovers itself. I don't want it just to be watered down Nissans.
Right.
That, you know, I'm thinking of a lot of the stuff that it did in the 80s and the 90s, especially even off-roading. Like, we only touched on that, but the Dakar Rally, there was a good period there where Mitsubishi's, the Pajero, which just here was the Montero, it dominated.
Dominated.
So, like, you can't, yeah. We can't discount that. It's been fun, and I want to talk more about Mitsubishi in the future. I want to show clips of, I don't know who remembers this, but in the late 80s and early 90s, Jackie Chan was Mitsubishi's like official cheerleader.
Yes.
And like,
oh, what movie was it where
there
where
were a couple?
He was stunt driving, I think, in Evo 4.
Yes. Yeah. There was a movie where Jackie Chan plays a race car driver driving a Mitsubishi. There's one where he drives this bizarre Mitsubishi concept convertible. Like,
and of course, we have to remember it was Cannonball Run 2, I think.
I think it's 2.
Well, he was in both. He was in both. But
was I was thinking it was just two, but okay.
I think it was 1.
Now I got
you. Where he had the little Mitsubishi hatchback with the jet engine that popped up, right? And it was like all-wheel drive. No, wait. That wasn't Mitsubishi.
That was Subaru.
That was Subaru. It was like some little Subaru hatchback that sounded like a freaking jet going down the road.
Anyway, we need to talk more about this.
We so need to talk more about this.
In the future, there will be a Jackie Chan car segment. That's what's going to happen.
Yes.
That's the way this is going to end.
I'm afraid for right now, though, we are running out of time. So we have to do a quick shout out to follow us on YouTube, like and subscribe. Hopefully you like the crazy content that we're talking about.
Exactly.
Even if sometimes we're a little off kilter, you can get us
like at, tonight. I know it's been tonight. Off the walls tonight, but like.
This is what it's all about.
Human beings, and sometimes we have weird days, but we want to create content for you. And like the word content is overplayed. We want to entertain you. Is basically the way it goes. Like, we want you to listen to us, to laugh, to like think, to, you know, we want to be there for you, and that's why we're here. That's why we're taking time out of our day to like perform for you, for lack of a better word.
I don't know if I'm performing, but
we are
talking cars, and it's just bare bones right here, right?
Yeah.
This is just bare bones, and this is what it's about to be a car guy or a car girl and just have a good time.
So. Yeah. So tonight, basically, it's Smith and I talking cars with each other, and you just happen to be listening.
You happen to listen. We happen to be recording.
Exactly.
I'm grateful for that. Catch us on Apple, on Spotify, on YouTube.
Apple Podcasts. No, is that what it's called? Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
We've been drinking way too much tonight.
No, I haven't been. It's just.
I've been drinking enough for both of us then.
There you go.
We post this every Friday on motorone.com. Of course, email us podcast@motorone.com. Tell us everything that we got wrong about Mitsubishi. Tell us everything we didn't talk about on Mitsubishi.
There's so much. Oh my God, guys. If you could see the list of notes I have, like I wanted to talk about so much more. And then there's a lot to talk about.
We also want to talk about your stories, listeners. Yes, we also want to see your cool cars. Do you have a cool Mitsubishi Starion project car? I want to see that because building those cars with a 2.6 liter, it's kind of a tough car to build. It doesn't have a big aftermarket like the Eclipse does. So if you have a Mitsubishi Starion project
car. Or if you have a Mitsubishi Starion with like 45,000 miles on it that just lived in your garage.
Since we're talking about the odd relationship, Dodge Conquest, the Dodge Conquest qualifies to
Chrysler Conquest, right?
I think they did both Chrysler and Dodge.
Maybe they did.
Such a strange relationship. Email us podcast@motorone.com. Bruce, take us out of this crazy session.
So as always, good afternoon, good evening, and good night. Thank you so much for listening to us. This has been one, it has been a busy week in the automotive scene. As you saw from the beginning, we're both frazzled. We're trying here. We love you. We love you for listening to us. And if you have anything to say, please, please, please comment. Please. Thank you. Good night. Bye-bye.